Justice Souter, with whom Justice Stevens, Justice Ginsburg, and Justice Breyer joined, dissenting. This case is here on the uncontested assumption that Bivens versus six unknown federal narcotics agents, 1971, allows personal liability based on a federal officer's violation of an individual's rights under the First and Fifth Amendments. And it comes to us with the explicit concession of petitioners Ashcroft and Miller that an officer may be subject to Bivens liability as a supervisor on grounds other than respondeat superior. The court apparently rejects this concession, and although it has no bearing on the majority's resolution of this case, does away with supervisory liability under Bivens. The majority then misapplies the pleading standard under Bell Atlantic Corporation versus Twombly to conclude that the complaint fails to state a claim. I respectfully dissent from both the rejection of supervisory liability as a cognizable claim in the face of petitioner's concession, and from the holding that the complaint fails to satisfy Rule 8A2 of the Federal Rules of Civil Procedure. Part 1, Section A. Respondent Iqbal was arrested in November 2001 on charges of conspiracy to defraud the United States and fraud in relation to identification documents, and was placed in pretrial detention at the Metropolitan Detention Center in Brooklyn, New York. He alleges that FBI officials carried out a discriminatory policy by designating him as a person of high interest in the investigation of the September 11th attacks solely because of his race, religion, or national origin. Owing to this designation, he was placed in the detention center's Administrative Maximum Special Housing Unit for over 6 months while awaiting the fraud trial. As I will mention more fully below, Iqbal contends that Ashcroft and Miller were at the very least aware of the discriminatory detention policy and condoned it, and perhaps even took part in devising it, thereby violating his First and Fifth Amendment rights. Iqbal claims that on the day he was transferred to the special unit, prison guards, without provocation, picked him up and threw him against the wall, kicked him in the stomach, punched him in the face, and dragged him across the room. He says that after being attacked a second time, he sought medical attention, but was denied care for 2 weeks. According to Iqbal's complaint, prison staff in the special unit subjected him to unjustified strip and body cavity searches, verbally berated him as a terrorist and a Muslim killer, refused to give him adequate food, and intentionally turned on air conditioning during the winter and heating during the summer. He claims that prison staff interfered with his attempts to pray and engage in religious study and with his access to counsel. The district court denied Ashcroft and Miller's motion to dismiss Iqbal's discrimination claim, and the Court of Appeals affirmed. Ashcroft and Miller then asked this court to grant certiorari on two questions. One, whether a conclusory allegation that a cabinet-level officer or other high-ranking official knew of, condoned, or agreed to subject a plaintiff to allegedly unconstitutional acts purportedly committed by subordinate officials is sufficient to state individual capacity claims against those officials under Bivens. And two, whether a cabinet-level officer or other high-ranking official may be held personally liable for the allegedly unconstitutional acts of subordinate officials on the ground that, as high-level supervisors, they had constructive notice of the discrimination allegedly carried out by such subordinate officials. The court granted certiorari on both questions. The first is about pleading. The second goes to the liability standard. In the first question, Ashcroft and Mueller did not ask whether a cabinet-level officer or other high-ranking official who knew of, condoned, or agreed to subject a plaintiff to allegedly unconstitutional acts committed by subordinate officials was subject to liability under Bivens. In fact, they conceded in their petition for certiorari that they would be liable if they had actual knowledge of discrimination by their subordinates and exhibited deliberate indifference to that discrimination. Instead, they asked the court to address whether Iqbal's allegations against them, which they call conclusory, were sufficient to satisfy Rule 8A2, and in particular, whether the Court of Appeals misapplied our decision in Twombly construing that rule. In the second question, Ashcroft and Mueller asked this court to say whether they could be held personally liable for the actions of their subordinates based on the theory that they had constructive notice of their subordinates' unconstitutional conduct. This was an odd question to pose, since Iqbal has never claimed that Ashcroft and Mueller are liable on a constructive notice theory. Be that as it may, the second question challenged only one possible ground for imposing supervisory liability under Bivens. In sum, both questions assumed that a defendant could raise a Bivens claim on theories of supervisory liability other than constructive notice, and neither question asked the parties or the court to address the elements of such liability. The briefing at the merits stage was no different. Ashcroft and Mueller argued that the factual allegations in Iqbal's complaint were insufficient to overcome their claim of qualified immunity. They also contended that they could not be held liable on a theory of constructive notice. Again, they conceded, however, that they would be subject to supervisory liability if they had actual knowledge of the assertedly discriminatory nature of the classification of suspects as being of high interest, and they were deliberately indifferent to that discrimination. Iqbal argued that the allegations in his complaint were sufficient under Rule 8A2 and Twombly, and conceded that as a matter of law he could not recover under a theory of respondeat superior. Thus, the parties agreed as to a proper standard of supervisory liability, and the disputed question was whether Iqbal's complaint satisfied Rule 8A2. Without acknowledging the parties' agreement as to the standard of supervisory liability, the court asserts that it must sua sponte decide the scope of supervisory liability here. I agree that absent Ashcroft's and Mueller's concession, that determination would have to be made. Without knowing the elements of the supervisory liability claim, there would be no way to determine whether a plaintiff had made factual allegations amounting to grounds for relief on that claim. But deciding the scope of supervisory Bivens liability in this case is uncalled for. There are several reasons, starting with the position Ashcroft and Mueller have taken and following from it. First, Ashcroft and Mueller have, as noted, made the critical concession that a supervisor's knowledge of a subordinate's unconstitutional conduct and deliberate indifference to that conduct are grounds for Bivens liability. Iqbal seeks to recover on a theory that Ashcroft and Mueller at least knowingly acquiesced, and maybe more than acquiesced, in the discriminatory acts of their subordinates. If he can show this, he will satisfy Ashcroft and Mueller's own test for supervisory liability. I would therefore accept Ashcroft and Mueller's concession for purposes of this case and proceed to consider whether the complaint alleges at least knowledge and deliberate indifference. Second, because of the concession, we have received no briefing or argument on the proper scope of supervisory liability, much less the full dress argument we normally require. We consequently are in no position to decide the precise contours of supervisory liability here, this issue being a complicated one that has divided the courts of appeals. This court recently remarked on the danger of bad decision-making when the briefing on a question is woefully inadequate. Yet today, the majority answers a question with no briefing at all. The attendant risk of error is palpable. Finally, the court's approach is most unfair to Iqbal. He was entitled to rely on Ashcroft's and Mueller's concession, both in their petition for certiorari and in their merits briefs, that they could be held liable on a theory of knowledge and deliberate indifference. By overriding that concession, the court denies Iqbal a fair chance to be heard on the question. Section B. The majority, however, does ignore the concession. According to the majority, because Iqbal concededly cannot recover on a theory of respondeat superior, it follows that he cannot recover under any theory of supervisory liability. The majority says that in a Bivens action, where masters do not answer for the torts of their servants, the term supervisory liability is a misnomer, and that absent vicarious liability, each government official, his or her title notwithstanding, is only liable for his or her own misconduct. Lest there be any mistake in these words, the majority is not narrowing the scope of supervisory liability, it is eliminating Bivens' supervisory liability entirely. The nature of a supervisory liability theory is that the supervisor may be liable under certain conditions for the wrongdoing of his subordinates, And it is this very principle that the majority rejects. The dangers of the majority's readiness to proceed without briefing and argument are apparent in its cursory analysis, which rests on the assumption that only two outcomes are possible here: respondeat superior liability, in which an employer is subject to liability for torts committed by employees while acting within the scope of their employment, or no supervisory liability at all. The dichotomy is false. Even if an employer is not liable for the actions of his employee solely because the employee was acting within the scope of employment, there still might be conditions to render a supervisor liable for the conduct of his subordinate. In fact, there is quite a spectrum of possible tests for supervisory liability. It could be imposed where a supervisor has actual knowledge of a subordinate's constitutional violation and acquiesces, or where supervisors know about the conduct and facilitate it, approve it, condone it, or turn a blind eye for fear that of what they might see, or where the supervisor has no actual knowledge of the violation but was reckless in his supervision of the subordinate, or where the supervisor was grossly negligent. I'm unsure what the general test for supervisory liability should be, and in the absence of briefing and argument, I'm in no position to choose or devise one. Neither is the majority. But what is most remarkable about its foray into supervisory liability is that its conclusion has no bearing on its resolution of the case. The majority says that all of the allegations in the complaint that Ashcroft and Mueller authorized, condoned, or even were aware of their subordinates' discriminatory conduct are conclusory and therefore are not entitled to be assumed true. As I explained below, this conclusion is unsound, but on the majority's understanding of Rule 8A2 pleading standards, even if the majority accepted Ashcroft and Mueller's concession and asked whether the complaint sufficiently alleges knowledge and deliberate indifference, it presumably would still conclude that the complaint fails to plead sufficient facts and must be dismissed.